Tonight on PBS News Weekend, as New Hampshire prepares for its first-in-the-nation primary, will Trump's remaining opponent be able to erode the former president's support?
We've got a lot of problems in this country that need addressing. And he's the only one that's had this level of experience. Day one, he's going to be able to come back into the office and get rolling like he never left.
Then how the discovery of lead in some applesauce pouches is exposing issues about how food reaches our shelves and who has oversight. And a new method of execution is set to be used in Alabama for the first time, raising questions about how states carry out the death penalty. Good evening, I'm John Yang. On this Sunday before the New Hampshire primary, the Republican presidential field has narrowed. Late this afternoon, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis ended his candidacy and endorsed Donald Trump. He made the announcement on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter.
It's clear to me that a majority of Republican primary voters want to give Donald Trump another chance. Well, I've had disagreements with Donald Trump, such as on the coronavirus pandemic and his elevation of Anthony Fauci. Trump is superior to the current incumbent, Joe Biden.
This makes the contest for the Republican presidential nomination a two-person race. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is the only other competitor than Trump. Lisa Desjardins has been in New Hampshire for the last few days. Right now she's in Hampton, New Hampshire. Lisa, I know this happened relatively late, but I also know you've probably been working the phone since it happened. What does this do to the race?
Well, if you ask former President Trump, and reporters did ask him a short time ago what this means, characteristically, former President Trump said he had the votes regardless. But for Nikki Haley, while some of her supporters say this gives her an opportunity to win over some new voters, the truth is, talking to those in her inner circle, they do believe that most of DeSantis's voters will go with former President Trump. However, they want to see any bump they can, because here in New Hampshire, while right now I'm told by those close to Nikki Haley that they think she will come in second, the margin will matter. The closer she can get to former President Trump here, the longer she has in this campaign, the more of a chance they say she can prove herself in South Carolina. So how much does it matter? It is probably a matter of margins, and it might be a small one, because really in the end of this, John, that's the reason DeSantis is dropping out. His margins of support here in New Hampshire and going forward in South Carolina were small. And it's not clear he had the money, despite initially having tens of millions of dollars at his disposal, a super PAC with over $100 million. This campaign imploded, and it's not clear that even has big enough margins to really make a massive difference in the campaign ahead for those who are left.
Let's talk about the dynamics of the campaign. How does this change campaigning and the message, perhaps, for both Nikki Haley and Donald Trump and moving forward after New Hampshire?
Well, for former President Trump, he already is trying to focus on South Carolina for a couple of reasons. That's because New Hampshire is his most competitive state, maybe the last place that he faces any kind of real competition, if you ask him and those around him. In fact, we went to a rally last night here in Manchester, New Hampshire. He introduced officials from South Carolina there. But what I noticed that was important, John, was the size of the crowd. I did an actual head count, and I counted over 4,100 people. That's significant because in that same venue 4 years ago, I saw 12,000 people come out for Donald Trump. Now, he has more events this year than that, but there could be an enthusiasm question for him going ahead. And when you ask Trump voters what they care about, it is the border, some cultural issues like transgender, but above it all is the economy.
I knew right from the beginning, because he has such great business sense, that he would make a great leader, and he did.
His opponents say there is a great risk in that he brings chaos. Some people see him as divisive.
We're in chaos right now, right? We have, you know, the cost of living is going up incredibly. There's violence and chaos everywhere.
Now, the latest FBI statistics, newly out from last year, actually show that violent crime is down last year. And in fact, we have been below pre-pandemic levels. Murder itself is plummeting in the United States. So this idea is out of step. It's a disconnect with the reality right now as far as crime, and especially in most cities in America. Now, as for the cost of living, Also, new statistics there, John, show that inflation has been improving. It is still around 3 to 4%, but it is dramatically down from 2022 when we saw the 7-8% levels. It's still higher than the Federal Reserve wants, 2%. And I will tell you, people are still feeling that, though. Whether the levels are going down, here I just spoke to someone in a bar, just I can see right across the way, told me he spent $110 to fill up his gas tank. And that is one reason he plans to vote for Donald Trump. So all of this is issues about for Joe Biden must face, but also issues for Nikki Haley.
Speaking of Joe Biden, there is a Democratic primary on Tuesday, but President Biden is not on the ballot. Why is that, and who is on the ballot?
Let me explain the calendar here, because this is incredibly unusual. First of all, the Democratic Party announced their schedule that they approved for the Democrats for their primaries, putting South Carolina first. That was something President Biden endorsed February 3rd. And then they were going to have Nevada and New Hampshire on February 6th after that, followed by Michigan, and then later on Super Tuesday. Well, New Hampshire has a law saying it has to be the first primary in the country, rejected the Democratic Party's dates, and instead decided to move their own primary up to where it is now on January 23rd. As punishment, John, the Democratic National Party said it will withhold delegates from the state of New Hampshire, and President Biden made the decision not to appear on the ballot at all. So some of his allies in this state are starting on their own a volunteer effort to write him in. The ballot has almost two dozen names on it, so people must write him in at the bottom. Trying to edge him out in this state is Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips. Seems like a long shot, but I got to tell you, the first surprise I've had on this campaign trail was an event he just had where he had a true surge of people. We'll see if they come out and if he has a chance to upset a write-in Joe Biden on Tuesday.
A week ago, Lisa, you were talking to voters in Iowa where turnout was relatively low. How did the feeling and the mood you're hearing in New Hampshire compared to what you heard in Iowa?
It is almost night and day. Still cold, but much more excitement here. You see yard signs all around the state. And if you just walk into any restaurant, you talk to someone at a coffee shop or at a gas station, they're tuned in and they're planning to vote. In Iowa, most people you talk to were not tuned in and were not planning to vote. They had a snowstorm, but it felt like it was more than that there. So more excitement here, I'd say, or at least people planning to vote more than in Iowa.
Lisa Desjardins, the excitement in New Hampshire. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Lisa will be reporting from New Hampshire for Tuesday night's live coverage of the primary starting at 11 p.m. Eastern here on PBS. In the day's other news, fighting between Russia and Ukraine ratcheted up today. Russian officials reported at least 27 people were killed and 25 others injured when Ukrainian forces shelled a market on the outskirts of Russian-occupied Donetsk. Forensic specialists were trying to figure out what kind of weapons were used. Ukraine had no comment on the incident. Donetsk is one of the four regions of Ukraine that Russia annexed illegally in 2022. A dark milestone today in the Israel-Hamas war. The Palestinian death toll in the conflict is now more than 25,000. That's according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. As Israeli shelling on Gaza continued for the 107th day of the war, Israeli officials said the fighting will likely continue for several more months. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu restated his opposition to a Palestinian state. That drew this reaction from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The refusal to accept the two-state solution for Israelis and Palestinians and the denial of the right to statehood for the Palestinian people are unacceptable. These would indefinitely prolong a conflict that has become a major threat to global peace and security, exacerbate polarization, and embolden extremists everywhere.
At a kibbutz in southern Israel, 1,000 people turned out to plant seedlings as a memorial to the victims of the October 7th Hamas attacks who were killed at a music festival nearby. Police said 364 people were shot, bludgeoned, or burned to death, and 40 others were taken hostage. Damage assessments are underway at a U.S. airbase in western Iraq. U.S. military officials said the Al-Assad airbase was attacked by rockets and ballistic missiles yesterday. It's believed to be the work of Iranian-backed militants. A number of U.S. personnel are being evaluated for traumatic brain injuries. There is an end in sight to the deep freeze that's taken a hold of much of the country. The National Weather Service expects temperatures to climb above freezing tomorrow in some parts of the central United States. Michigan City, Indiana is still digging out from 3 feet of lake effect snow that fell on Friday, but the city emergency has been lifted. Winter storms have claimed at least 67 lives this month nationwide. Indonesia's most active volcano, Mount Merapi, has erupted, forcing thousands to evacuate. The volcano unleashed searing gas clouds that blanketed several surrounding villages and a deluge of lava that spread over a mile. No casualties have been reported from this latest event. Today's eruption is one of several volcanoes to flare up in the country this weekend. And the world finally knows the motive behind the case of the stolen ruby slippers. In 2018, the FBI recovered the footwear Judy Garland made famous in The Wizard of Oz. Court papers say known mobster Terry John Martin stole them from the Judy Garland Museum in Minnesota in 2005. He says he was in pursuit of one last score. Smith, who said he's never seen the movie, thought the rubies were real. 2 days later, he found out they were just glass and ditched them. Smith pleaded guilty, and prosecutors are asking that he be spared prison. The 76-year-old is in hospice care, not expected to live another 6 months. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, how lead ended up in applesauce pouches and why the scheduled execution of an Alabama man is raising concerns.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
The effects of last fall's recall of applesauce pouches with high concentrations of lead are widening. As Ali Rogan reports, it's raising questions about how food reaches supermarket shelves, who watches over it, and how far that oversight extends.
The contaminated pouches were first discovered back in October, but only because health officials in North Carolina were doing routine blood lead level screenings. Hundreds of cases are now under investigation. The FDA has confirmed that highly contaminated cinnamon was the culprit. The applesauce pouches were produced in Ecuador and sold in U.S. supermarkets, on Amazon, and in stores like Dollar Tree. Helena Bodemiller-Evich is the founder and editor of Food Fix, a publication that focuses on food policy. She's been tracking this unfolding recall. Helena, thank you so much for being here. How has the impact of these recalled pouches expanded since this news first broke? And what do we expect about the scope? Do we think it's going to continue to increase?
Yeah, so about 3 months ago, we knew of 4 kids in North Carolina who had elevated blood lead levels. And since then, we have now gone to over 350 cases under investigation by federal health officials in 41 states. So this has expanded quite substantially. I think 350 is likely an undercount, just considering how hard it is for people to hear about this and also get their kids tested from their pediatrician. So I think it's an undercount. I don't know how many more kids will end up under investigation, but it's certainly a tragedy that should never have happened.
Absolutely. What are we talking about in terms of symptoms, and how serious is this for children, who are, of course, the vast majority of the people eating these pouches?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that lead is a neurotoxin, and there's a pretty strong scientific consensus that there's no safe level of lead, particularly for young children and infants. It can cause lowered IQ, developmental problems, behavioral problems. So this is a really serious issue. In this case, the lead levels were very high. The cinnamon was actually found to have 2,000 times higher levels than what would be considered safe under international standards. That said, children probably wouldn't be exhibiting symptoms. So the key message here is that if you or your child consumed these recalled pouches, which you can check at FDA.gov, you should get your blood tested regardless of whether you have symptoms.
That's really good advice there. The applesauce contamination is an example of some of the vulnerabilities that exist within the global supply chain. How much control does the FDA have over, we're talking about worldwide supply chains? What does that look like?
Yeah, in this case, we're learning about some of the holes and limitations of FDA's jurisdiction. So in this situation in particular, it was a company in Ecuador that made the pouches, and FDA was able to get access to that plant and test the cinnamon. They found extremely high levels of lead, like off the charts. I mentioned 2,000 times higher than international safety standards, so really high levels. They also found chromium, which is another metal that we don't know a lot about, but it potentially suggests lead chromate was the culprit here, so probably points to economic adulteration. Lead chromate can be used to make spices appear brighter. It also contains lead, so it is very much something we want to keep out of the spice supply. In this situation, FDA was not able to go further up the supply chain to the cinnamon supplier because that cinnamon supplier is not sending food directly to the U.S. So we're finding some limitations just in terms of what FDA is able to do. Ecuador is continuing to investigate, though I've had a lot of trouble getting updates from Ecuador about how that investigation is going.
And is that really where this falls through the cracks if the manufacturers, if the suppliers are not traveling specifically through the United States? Is the oversight there that the FDA has, is that where it gets really limited?
So that's where they have jurisdiction. If you're shipping food to the U.S., FDA has jurisdiction over that. In this case, going further up the supply chain is the issue. And the reason that's an issue is that cinnamon is primarily coming from China, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, or Vietnam. So didn't come from Ecuador, probably. And so we need to find where the cinnamon originally came from and where it got contaminated. Because if it was economic adulteration, they want to know where that happened and where else the cinnamon may have gone. The good news is FDA has been doing a lot more screening of cinnamon coming into the U.S., and they have so far not found high levels of lead. So that is the good news. But there are limitations here, and even what FDA is able to screen, they do not have enough inspectors to really be in foreign food plants very often.
And to that point, though, the FDA is not routinely screening for heavy metals, right?
So when it comes to spices, we actually don't have limits for heavy metals and spices. We also don't have heavy metals limits for most baby foods, and FDA is under pressure to set limits for baby foods in particular, because we know this is such a vulnerable population. The agency has been very slow to do so. They are working on that now. And I think this situation puts a lot of additional pressure on the agency to move forward on that, because parents shouldn't have to think about this. This is something you expect the food industry regulators to take care of. This is not something parents should be thinking about.
Absolutely. Helena Bottomiller-Evich, founder and editor of Food Fix, thank you so much for breaking this all down for us.
Happy to be here.
Later this week, unless the courts intervene, a death row inmate in Alabama is set to become the first person in the United States put to death using an untested method called nitrogen hypoxia. It's also called nitrogen suffocation or nitrogen asphyxiation. In 1996, Kenneth Eugene Smith was convicted and sentenced to death in a murder-for-hire plot. Alabama tried to execute him in 2022 using lethal injection, but it failed when the execution team couldn't find a vein after trying for nearly 2 hours. That attempt, he told NPR, haunts him as a new execution date approaches.
I'm still carrying trauma from the last time. I'm being treated for PTSD, and I struggle daily. Everybody is telling me that I'm going to suffer. So I'm absolutely terrified.
Only three states authorize nitrogen hypoxia as an alternate execution method: Alabama, Mississippi, and Oklahoma. Last week, the Alabama Solicitor General called it the most painless and humane method of execution known to man. The UN Human Rights Office says it could amount to torture. Robin Maher is executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Robin, first of all, what is this method, and what do we know about how Alabama plans to implement it?
Well, what we know about it is what Alabama has chosen to share with us in a highly redacted protocol, which conceals certain critical details and also raises more questions about its safety and its effectiveness. The broad outlines are that Mr. Smith will be fitted with a mask, a face mask, and be forced to breathe pure nitrogen gas. At that point, his organs will begin to fail and ultimately death will result. That's the theory. But it's only a theory, because this has never been used before in an execution in the United States, nor anywhere in the world, as far as we know.
What could go wrong? What are the worries about what could go wrong?
Well, Mr. Smith's lawyers have argued a few certain things. One is that they're worried about the face mask itself, the way that it fits on his face. If it becomes dislodged for any reason, for example, if Mr. Smith begins to panic, or if it's dislodged when he's praying audibly or making a final statement, then that could affect the flow of the gas and prolong his execution. The other question is the safety of others in the room. We're worried about people like the religious advisor who will be with him. He's been forced to sign an acknowledgement that he understands the dangers he'll be in with this use of odorless and colorless gas. And Mr. Smith's lawyers also argue that he may vomit in the mask and aspirate, which would also prolong his suffering and his death.
Why are states looking for alternate methods of execution?
Well, that story really began several years ago, and when pharmaceutical companies discovered that their drugs were being used in executions. They responded by withdrawing some of these drugs or refusing to sell them to prisons, and that led states to do a variety of things. Some began compounding their own drugs. Some began experimenting with different combinations of drugs that had never been tested before, and what we saw then was a series of botched executions, really gruesome spectacles of people that were obviously in a lot of pain and distress during their execution. So now states have turned to identifying alternate methods. Some of them have gone back to old methods like electrocution and firing squad, and Alabama will be the first to use nitrogen gas.
How do states approach using a new technique? I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, lethal injection was new at one point. How do they approach this?
Well, you know, part of the problem here is that we don't have all of the details. And transparency and accountability, those are principles of good governance everywhere. What we don't have from Alabama is a clear understanding of what it knows and how this procedure will go forward. And I think that's what's prompting a lot of concerns.
Only 5 states carried out capital punishment last year. And there are many states that have the death penalty, but just have not carried it out. What does this tell us, if anything, about the Americans' attitudes and approach toward capital punishment?
Well, I think it tells us a lot. I mean, first of all, as you say, very few states are still using the death penalty. Very few states are still imposing new death sentences. The majority of the country has really turned away from using the death penalty. And there was an important new poll, public opinion poll that came out, in which it said for the first time, more Americans believe the death penalty is administered unfairly than fairly. They've lost trust. They've lost confidence that the death penalty can be used in a fair and accurate manner. And that I think, spells a real change for the death penalty in the United States going forward.
I mean, aside from the method that Alabama wants to use in this execution, is the question that they had already tried to execute him and failed. Can a second attempt be made? Has this ever happened before?
Oh, this is extraordinarily rare. It happened quite recently, again in Alabama, just a few years ago. But it is extraordinarily rare for someone to survive an execution attempt. And as you heard from the clip, you know, Mr. Smith is still suffering the effects from that botched execution attempt. The UN certainly has said it has concerns that this is a kind of torture. And so the Supreme Court is being asked to look at that very question in its upcoming case.
Robin Maher, the Death Penalty Information Center, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Now online, as COVID cases are on the rise, why doctors are worried about the repercussions of misinformation. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. On Monday's PBS NewsHour, the latest from New Hampshire on the eve of the first of the nation primary as the race narrows to 2. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.